What adds to this impression is that Jacobs has also found a geodetic relationship between Haran and the fabled Mesopotamian city of Ur, with which it was known to have enjoyed a close relationship in antiquity. The history myth of Mesopotamia, Jacobs says, holds that Ur and Haran are two important related Sumerian centers, both associated with the moon. I checked the latitude of the Ur ziggurat at 30.963 degrees. At first, I did not notice co-latitude equals 5 over 3 arctangent, atan. Co-latitude is the distance to the nearest pole, a geodetic reference point. Latitude references the equator, the mid-pole's plane perpendicular to the rotation axis. The local level plane at Haran intersects the rotation axis at 4 over 3 atan angle, forming a 3-4-5 right triangle, as does latitude in relation to the equator and geodetic center. Summarizing, co-latitude at Haran equals 4 over 3 atan and at Ur 5 over 3 atan. This latitude at Haran equals 3 over 4 atan and at Ur 3 over 5 atan. Perhaps these idolaters were doing astronomy. I would go further and say undoubtedly the Sabian star worshippers of Haran were doing astronomy. And given the evidence we've reviewed in chapters 14 and 15 for precise calculations of precession by the makers of Göbekli Tepe, so precise that they were able to create a symbolic picture of the winter solstice sky in our own epoch, 11,600 years in the future, I'm not surprised by further evidence in this region of extremely ancient and extremely precise scientific astronomy and geodesy. This evidence goes far beyond the capabilities normally attributed to the historical civilization of Mesopotamia. And because it draws back the veil, requiring us to look very deeply into prehistory, it again raises the specter of a lost civilization. Jacobs has noticed this and admits to being puzzled by it. His final discovery of relevance here concerns the geodetic relationship between Göbekli Tepe and Haran. The sites, says Jacobs, are apparently indivisible, just over 40 kilometers apart. The difference in latitude from Haran to Göbekli Tepe equals precisely 1/1000th of Earth's circumference. This is where we enter a twilight zone in ancient astronomy. Of course, the opposite metaphor, the dawn of ancient astronomy, is the proper one regarding the implication. Göbekli Tepe features the oldest known room aligned north-south, evidence of astronomy in practice. Even non-archaeos, Jacobs continues, understand stratification and deposition basics. Deeper is older. Göbekli Tepe is 12,000 years old. Haran is equated with Ur of Sumeria, the civilized land and a cradle of civilization. That cradle and astronomy is presumed to be 4,000 to 5,000 years old, not 12,000. Haran is located at 3 over 4 atan latitude, a fixed parameter, and Göbekli Tepe is at a specific latitude difference north. Because the fixed parameter must come first, the conundrum, of course, is that this precise 1/1000th of circumference latitude difference is either a coincidence or ancient astronomy just took a leap back to 12,000 years ago. My understanding is that Jacobs is no fan of alternative history, and he has commented forthrightly on the amount of utterly unbelievable pseudoscience that is presently in circulation on the internet and in the media concerning Göbekli Tepe. Kudos to him, therefore, for going where the genuine science takes him and keeping an open mind to the possibility that ancient astronomy and precise Earth measuring may indeed go back much further into the twilight zone than mainstream archaeology has hitherto supposed. The Magi of Haran. As Haran was in its beginning, a center of the exact sciences, as Jacobs proposes, so it continued to be throughout the millennia when the Sabians practiced their star worship here. As late as the 9th century AD, Albertani, better known in the West as Albertegnius, arguably the most distinguished astronomer and mathematician of the Middle Ages, was born in Haran and went on during a long and distinguished life to record many remarkable scientific achievements. Of particular note, combining both exact astronomy and exact geodesy, was his calculation of the greatest distance of the Moon from the Earth. Since the Moon's orbit is elliptical, it has both a perigee, the point at which it is closest to the Earth, and an apogee, the point at which it is furthest away. Al-Battani's estimate of the Moon's distance at apogee was within 0.6% of the modern value. He is also noted for his calculation of the length of the solar year at 365 days, 5 hours, 46 minutes and 24 seconds, an error of only 2 minutes 22 seconds when compared with the figure produced by modern astronomers with the benefit of advanced technology. Al-Battani catalogued 489 stars, produced more accurate measurements of the sun's path than Copernicus would achieve 600 years later, and gave important trigonometric formulae for right triangles, a fact of the history of science that is perhaps noteworthy in view of the relationship of Haran's latitude to right 3-4-5 triangles discussed above. Al-Battani's full name, which includes a number of revealing epithets, was Abu Abdallah Al-Battani ibn Jabir ibn Sinan al-Raqi al-Harani al-Sabi. The origin of the epithet Al-Battani itself is unknown, but is conjectured to refer to a street or district of Haran, his birth city, from whence Al-Harani is of course also derived. Al-Raqi refers to the city of Al-Raqa on the Euphrates River in Syria, where Al-Battani spent much of his working life. Most interesting, however, is the epithet Al-Sabi, which according to the authoritative Dictionary of Scientific Biography indicates that Al-Battani's ancestors, if not he himself, had professed the religion of the Haranian Sabians, in which a considerable amount of the ancient Mesopotamian astral theology and star lore appears to have been preserved, and which, tolerated by the Muslim rulers, survived until the middle of the 11th century. The fact that Al-Battani's elder contemporary, the great mathematician and astronomer Thabit ibn Qurra, hailed from the same region and still adhered to the Sabian religion seems indicative of the keen interest in astronomy that characterized even this last phase of Mesopotamian star idolatry. Thabit ibn Qurra, AD 836 to 901, and also born in Haran, would have had little patience with loaded terms like star idolatry, which seek to place the paganism of the Sabians on a lower level than the deadly and often bigoted, narrow-minded and unscientific clerical monotheism of religions like Christianity, Judaism and Islam. Thabit was well aware that underlying the ancient Sabian practices misunderstood by these young religions as star idolatry were indeed exact sciences of great benefit to mankind, and thus he wrote, "Who else have civilized the world and built the cities, if not the nobles and kings of paganism? Who else have set in order the harbors and rivers, and who else have taught the hidden wisdom? To whom else has the deity revealed itself, given oracles, and told about the future, if not the famous men amongst the pagans? The pagans have made known all this. They have discovered the art of healing the soul, and they have also made known the art of healing the body. They have filled the earth with settled forms of government, and with wisdom, which is the highest good. Without paganism, the world would be empty and miserable." To the above should be added that even this translation fails to do justice to what Thabit was attempting to convey here. The Syriac word hanputho that he used in his original text, and that is translated above as paganism, in fact means the pure religion. Its cognate in Arabic is the word hanif, which appears in the Quran, referencing ancient pre-Islamic faiths that were regarded as pure and thus not to be persecuted. Indeed, the Sabians were accorded recognition by many leading thinkers in the early centuries of Islam as the archetypal Hanifs, and this, together with their famous claim to be a people of the book, was amongst the reasons why they were left free for so long to practice the old ways. We've already seen how the Sabians were allowed to build a new temple of the moon god and to continue their religious rites after the Arab general Ibn Ghanem conquered Haran in the 7th century AD. This in itself is a sign of most unusual favor, since Islamic armies normally offered pagans the choice of either conversion or death. Even more interesting, however, is the Sabaeans' encounter with the Abbasid caliph Abu Ja'far Abdullah al-Ma'mun, who passed through their city in AD 830 and reportedly quizzed them intensively on their religion. Remembering the Sabaean pilgrimages to Giza, it is reasonable to wonder whether there is any connection with the fact that in AD 820, a decade before he visited Haran, it was Ma'mun who tunneled into the Great Pyramid and opened its previously hidden passageways and chambers. Indeed, it is through Ma'mun's hole that visitors still enter the monument today. Described by Gibbon as a prince of rare learning, it seems Ma'mun's investigation was prompted by information he'd received about the Great Pyramid. Specifically, that it contained a secret chamber with maps and tables of the celestial and terrestrial spheres. Although they were said to have been made in the remote past, they were supposed to be of great accuracy. Like his father, Harun al-Rashid of Arabian Nights fame, Ma'mun belonged to a line of learned and open-minded caliphs. By the 11th century, however, when the last temple of the moon god in Haran was finally destroyed, a new, more fundamentalist and far less tolerant faction had seized the reins of Islam, and the suppression of the pure religion of the Sabaeans began in earnest. We know they continued to make their pilgrimages to Giza until the 13th century, but after that they disappear from history, and while some scholars feel that elements of their faith survive amongst such sects as the Mandeans and the Yazidis of Iraq, who themselves have been subjected to intense Islamic persecution in modern times, there seems to be no trace left of the Sabaeans today, except for one tantalizing and intriguing thought. The Sacred Book of the Sabaeans was the compilation of texts now known as the Hermetica, a copy of which, most mysteriously, found its way into the hands of Leonardo da Pistoia, an agent of Cosimo de' Medici, founder of the Medici political dynasty of Florence. It was 1460, and Pistoia was traveling in Macedonia at the time, but immediately returned to Florence with the treasure of ancient wisdom that he had acquired. With equal speed, Cosimo ordered his adopted son Marsilio Ficino to delay translation of the complete works of Plato on which he had just begun, and to translate the Hermetica instead. It was, as the late Dame Frances Yates, one of the world's leading experts on the Renaissance, has observed, an extraordinary situation. Indeed so, particularly since there is much to suggest that it was this introduction of Hermetic ideas into 15th century Europe that kicked the Renaissance into high gear and gave birth to the modern world. Or was it, perhaps, not so much the birth of a new world as it was the rebirth, the resurrection in the language of the Edfu texts, of the former world of the gods? Signs of the Hands. As we have seen, the Edfu texts speak of the seven sages, bringers of wisdom to mankind, teachers of science and magic. The Mesopotamian texts also speak of seven sages, the Apkalus, whose functions are identical to those of their Egyptian counterparts. We have explored all this in earlier chapters and need not repeat ourselves here. What I was unaware of, however, until I began to investigate the traditions of the Watchers in the Book of Enoch, the Book of Jubilees, and elsewhere, is that scholars have discovered close links between the Watchers and the Apkalus. For example, figurines of Apkalus were buried in boxes in the foundation deposits in Mesopotamian buildings in order to avert evil. The term Masare, Watchers, is used of these sets. Likewise, the Apkalus were said to have taught antediluvian sciences to humanity, and so too were the Watchers. As one scholar concludes, however, the Jewish authors often inverted the Mesopotamian intellectual traditions with the intention of showing the superiority of their own cultural foundations. Thus, the antediluvian sages, the Mesopotamian Apkalus, were demonized as the sons of God and appear as the Watchers, illegitimate teachers of humankind before the flood. All in all, what this body of research reveals is a series of links between the Watchers and the Apkalus, so close that they might reasonably be supposed to be two different names or titles for the same beings. There is neither space nor need here to explore this material with all its multiple interconnections in any further detail. But I find it tempting to imagine that it might be these very beings, these watchers, these sages, who are depicted on the tall megalithic pillars at Göbekli Tepe. Notwithstanding their resemblance to the symbols of Mesopotamian deities, the presence of the bag-like objects on the upper register of Pillar 43 in Enclosure D that I first drew attention to in Chapter 1 continues to intrigue me, since these objects are also so similar to the bags held in the hands of the Apkallu figures in many ancient depictions. And that similarity, as the reader will recall, is not confined to the Near East. In a sculpture from the Olmec site of La Venta, overlooking the Gulf of Mexico, a relief of Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent, the legendary bringer of civilization to the peoples of Central America, carries an identical bag. Before leaving Turkey in July 2014, we make one more trip back to Göbekli Tepe. I can hardly bear to see it under its horrible, heavy wooden roof, which plunges all four of the main enclosures into a looming, sepulchral gloom. But there's a particular reason why I want to take a final look at Enclosure D, not this time at Pillar 43, but at the two central pillars with their crooked arms and their hands with long fingers that almost meet over their stone bellies. When I'm satisfied I've seen enough, we have our driver take us back to Sanliurfa, to the main museum, where numerous artifacts from Göbekli Tepe, thought too precious to leave at the site, are on display. I've been here before too, but there are a number of details I want to remind myself of. I spend a long time in front of a mesmerizing sculpture of a human figure. It wasn't found at Göbekli Tepe, but was an accidental discovery made in the 1980s in Sanliurfa itself, in the heart of the old town, where deep foundations were being dug for a car park. It has been dated to the Göbekli Tepe period, in other words, to around 9000 BC, and is on its way, Klaus Schmidt has written, to become world famous as the oldest completely preserved life-sized statue of mankind. Unlike the megalithic pillars at Göbekli Tepe, where the heads are stylized, resembling the upper crossbar of the letter T, this figure has a fully formed human head and face with glittering black obsidian eyes, a pronounced chin that gives every impression of being bearded, a pectoral in the form of a large double V carved in high relief across its chest, and its arms crooked in the manner of the Göbekli Tepe figures, with the fingers almost meeting across the front of the belly. I move on to the second piece I want to examine, the so-called totem pole. It's even eerier than the first. Again, it's about normal human height, but it is by no means entirely human. Instead, it's a complex hybrid with multiple different characteristics. The head is badly damaged, but the ears and eyes have been preserved and suggest a predator of some kind, perhaps a bear, or perhaps a lion or leopard, so it's a therianthrope. Then large serpents wind up along the outside of its legs. They have oversized heads which project forward at about the level of the figure's groin. There are two sets of arms and hands that seem to belong to the figure itself. In the case of the upper pair, the arms are crooked in the usual Göbekli Tepe manner, and the hands are brought together, with the fingers almost touching across the chest. Then there's a second pair of what seem to be forearms and hands only, with the fingers again coming together and almost touching across the belly, roughly at the level of the navel. Moving down, at about the level of the genitals, a small head and two further arms protrude outwards from the midline of the figure. Again, there are those long-fingered hands almost meeting, but this time they appear to be playing a drum. Beside them, but just below them, there is the hint, much damaged, of a further pair of arms and hands. Much about all this is familiar to me. Very familiar. Not from Göbekli Tepe, though, as we'll see in the next chapter, but from the far side of the world. Part 7. Distance. Chapter 17. Mountain. It's October 2013, and I'm on the slopes above the city of Cusco in the high Andes of Peru, exploring the incredible megalithic site of Sacsayhuaman with Jesus Gamarra, a descendant of the Incas. Gamarra is in his mid-70s, more than 10 years older than me, but you'd never guess it from looking at him. He's as nimble as a mountain goat, fully acclimatized to the altitude of 3,701 meters, 12,142 feet, and fit as an Olympic athlete after years of clambering around the passes and trails of his homeland during a lifetime of research into the origins of Inca culture. My first visit to Sacsayhuaman was in 1992, and I've been back many times since, always learning something new. In Fingerprints of the Gods, published in 1995, I expressed my skepticism of the orthodox theory that practically all of the great monuments of the Andes are the work of the Incas, whose empire was not much more than a century old at the start of the Spanish conquest of Peru in 1531. Since it was known that the Incas made extensive use of Sacsayhuaman, I wrote in Fingerprints, I could easily understand why it had been assumed that they had built it. But there was no obvious or necessary connection between these two propositions. The Incas could just as well have found the structures already in place and moved into them. In Heaven's Mirror, 1998, I further developed the argument that the gigantic megalithic and rock-hewn constructions of the Andes, which are by no means confined to Sacsayhuaman but are found all over the region, were not the work of the Incas, but of a much earlier predecessor civilization long lost to history. In such an event, it is not necessary to imagine a complete break in continuity between the hypothesized elder culture and the Incas. On the contrary, the latter could have inherited some of the traditions and knowledge of the former and attempted on a smaller scale to mimic their cyclopean world. I didn't know Gamarra or his work when I wrote the passages quoted above. Now, as he shows me around Sacsayhuaman, carefully and painstakingly explaining everything he wants me to see, taking me to hidden nooks and corners of the site that I was completely unaware of before, he opens my eyes to all sorts of details that support and reinforce my earlier intuitions. More than that, he presents a solid archaeological case, originally worked out by his father Alfredo Gamarra, and greatly refined and extended by himself, that would, I feel, be worthy of serious consideration by mainstream scholars. If that is, the mainstream were not so locked into the rigid preconception that all these monuments are just a few hundred years old and entirely the work of the Incas. It's notoriously difficult to know with any useful level of certainty the age of anonymous, uninscribed stone monuments. Carbon dating of associated organic materials is only useful when we can be absolutely certain that the materials being dated were deposited at the same time as the cutting and placing of the stone we are interested in. In the case of many megalithic structures, this is impossible. Surface luminescence dating, which we saw in Chapter 10, has already produced some anomalous results at the Pyramid of Menkaure and at the Sphinx and Valley Temples of Giza, has not yet been widely taken up by the archaeological establishment, and has never been applied to the monuments of the Andes. In the absence of useful objective tests, therefore, the next routine strategy is to look at architectural style and methods. Just as different styles of pottery can often provide reliable indications as to what culture in what period made a particular piece, so too with architecture. The rule of thumb is that very different styles and approaches to the construction or creation of stone monuments, even if they stand side by side, are indicative of the involvement of different cultures working at different periods in the past. Unfortunately, this logical and reasonable technique of stylistic dating is not popular with archaeologists studying the monuments of the Andes, perhaps because if they were to deploy it here, as they do elsewhere, they'd be forced to question the established theory that the Incas made everything. Archaeology is a deeply conservative discipline, and I have found that archaeologists, no matter where they are working, have a horror of questioning anything their predecessors and peers have already announced to be true. They run a very real risk of jeopardizing their careers if they do. In consequence, they focus, perhaps to a large extent subconsciously, on evidence and arguments that don't upset the apple cart. There might be room for some tinkering around the edges, some refinement of orthodox ideas, but God forbid that anything should be discovered that might seriously undermine the established paradigm. What Gamarra is showing me as we walk around Sacsayhuaman is that there are three distinctly different styles of architecture here, so different indeed that it is extremely difficult to understand why archaeologists insist they are all the work of the same Inca culture and were all made during the century or so prior to the arrival of the Spanish. It is unnecessary to repeat the detailed descriptions of this site that I have given in my earlier books. In brief, however, Sacsayhuaman stands on a hillside above and overlooking the city of Cusco and consists of a series of three parallel rows of walls, all about 6 meters, 20 feet high, constructed entirely of gigantic megaliths, some weighing in excess of 360 tons, each wall offering a jagged, almost zigzag profile, built into the side of a slope and arranged in step fashion, one above the other. Past the uppermost wall, the slope continues to rise towards the south and is littered with the ruins of a number of much smaller buildings. One of these, right at the top, consisting of three concentric circles of nicely cut blocks, preserved at foundation level only, must have been impressive when it was intact. Beyond it, a valley overgrown with trees and dense bushes slopes steeply down to the south, with Cusco nestling in its floor. Turning northwards, a grassy plateau, perhaps 100 meters wide, extends from the base of the lowest of the three megalithic walls, along its full length of some 400 meters. On the north side of the plateau, a natural rocky knoll of volcanic diorite rises, but it has been cut and shaped into intricate terrace and step formations. This is where Gamarra and I are now standing, and he launches into an explanation. "This is Hananpacha work," he says, indicating the beautifully cut diorite terraces at our feet. "The first world. It was made thousands of years before the time of the Incas. They knew how to shape stone then," a mischievous grin. "They could do anything they wanted with it. Maybe it was easy for them." He stoops, beckons for me to look closely at the surface of the rock. "You see?" I shrug. I'm puzzled. I'm not sure what he wants me to see. "No tool marks," he says. He gestures proudly at the whole carved, sculpted artifact, the whole gigantic work of art that the knoll has been transformed into. "No tool marks anywhere." "So what did they do? Buff the tool marks off after they'd cut the stone?" "No," says Gamarra. "They didn't need tools. They had another way. It was the same in the second world, too, which I call Uranpacha." He points to the looming megalithic walls opposite. "There is some disagreement amongst the experts about exactly what kind of stone they're made from and where it was quarried. The consensus, although some green diorite porphyry and some andesite are also present, is that a very hard and dense form of local limestone was used for the megaliths themselves. Quarries at 15 kilometers distance and at 3 kilometers distance have been identified as sources for the limestone." We scramble down the side of the knoll and across the grassy plaza until we stand beneath the courses of hulking megaliths that have become the definitive image that Sacsayhuaman now projects to the world. As always when I'm here, my first sensation is of wonder. I feel small, diminished, pint-sized. It's not just that the walls and the blocks they're built of are big. They seem to have, dare I say it, a personality of their own, and it is the personality of a slumbering giant. What's spectacular about these walls, quite apart from their size, quite apart from the fact that there are at least 1,000 individual blocks, is the breathtaking, virtuoso feat that has been performed in joining them together. I mean, let's be serious here. When you are building a wall in which the smallest block you plan to use weighs a ton, while the majority weigh over 20 tons, where many weigh 100 tons, some weigh 200 tons, and a few weigh more than 300 tons, you have already set yourself a formidable logistical challenge. But then suppose, just for the hell of it, you decide to up the ante a little more, and insist that these walls must be constructed in the form of huge three-dimensional jigsaw puzzles. Every block has to be a polygon with anywhere between 6 and 12 sides. Every polygon has to be different, no two alike, and they must all fit together with one another so tightly that you won't be able to get a razor blade between the joints. I can't speak for the back of the blocks, where they lock into other blocks behind them, again, presumably multidimensionally. But the patterns made along their weird cyclopean facades are already complicated enough, without considering what's going on out of sight. It's obvious, gazing up in stupefied awe at the scale and complexity of the project, that this must have been an incredibly difficult thing to do. whoever was responsible for Sacsayhuaman's megalithic phase can only have been top-class professionals with years of experience behind them and a very long tradition of distilled knowledge to draw upon. You can't conceive and plan and build something like this with only a century or two of trial and error behind you, as is supposed to be the case with the Incas. These megaliths of Sacsayhuaman are the mature work of grand masters of stone. Moreover, throughout the Andes, there is no evidence of apprentices learning how to do this, no early prototypes that are good but don't quite succeed. Other structures might not be on the scale of Sacsayhuaman, though many come close, but all of them, whether at Pisac or Ollanta Tambo or Machu Picchu or at a score of other sites, share the same level of complexity while embracing different challenges, such as extremely difficult locations very far from the quarries that Sacsayhuaman does not have to overcome. All of them are masterworks, from the beginning. All of them are perfect. It's almost as if, as Gamara says, it was easy for them. I know he has a theory to explain this. The theory is that gravity was lower during his first two worlds, the Hananpacha stage and the Uranpacha stage, and that this made stone lighter and easier to manipulate. The lowered gravity is linked in his mind with the notion that the Earth once made much closer orbits around the Sun, an orbit of 225 days, and an orbit of 260 days, before settling into its present 365-day path. He could be right. New science suggests that the orbits of the planets are not fixed and stable, but can be subject to radical changes that, amongst other things, are capable of increasing the flux of comets into the inner solar system. However, this isn't the part of his theory I'm interested in. Where I feel he is solidly persuasive is in his observations of the anomalous character of the monuments of the Andes, observations that are based on 50 years of his own fieldwork and 60 years of fieldwork by his father. The Gamaras have walked the walk and earned the right to speak out on this matter, and when they speak, though they themselves are of Inca descent, their message is absolutely clear. Many of the great architectural works that are attributed to the Incas were not made by the Incas. There are traces of a lost civilization here. Indeed, not just one lost civilization, but if Gamara's time frame is correct, two. All the big blocks of Sacsayhuaman are from the Uranpacha period, he says. We're standing in a corner at a junction of a dozen or so of these incredible blocks. Gamara highlights again the precision of their joints that look as though some modern machine tool has been at work, and the daunting complexity of the patterns they form. Then he draws my attention to something else. Several of the blocks have weird circular hollows and shallow tracks with raised edges scalloped into their faces, along with other peculiar, seemingly random patterns. No tool marks, he reiterates. No chisels. No hammers. So, how did they do it? Doesn't it look, Gamara asks, like they worked with the stone when it was soft? He runs his hand along the curves and angles of a polygonal joint, like butter, so they could mold everything together. Suddenly, all becomes clear. The strange shapes I'm seeing in the rock would be easy, indeed effortless to create if these blocks were made of something of the consistency of room temperature butter instead of cold, hard limestone. Then, as well as molding them together to create this massive jigsaw puzzle effect, the tip of a table knife could be used to gouge out the shallow scallops, and the back of a spoon would serve to make the hollows. It's an attractive idea, and I don't have to buy into Gamara's theories about orbits and gravity in order to explore it further. There are other ways of explaining the patterns. For example, the technology of a lost civilization might have been up to the challenge of softening rock so that it could be worked like butter. Perhaps heat was involved. An intriguing study by the Institute of Tectonics and Geophysics of the Russian Academy of Sciences, working in cooperation with Peru's Ministry of Culture, produced evidence that the limestone of the Sacsayhuaman megaliths was at some point subjected to temperatures in excess of 900 degrees centigrade, and possibly as high as 1,100 degrees centigrade. When the Russian researchers went to the quarries where the blocks are believed to have been cut, they found the natural limestone filled with tiny organic fossils. This is what you would expect, since limestone is a sedimentary rock that forms under ancient seas and consists largely of the remains of tiny shells and the microskeletons of other marine organisms. Strangely, when samples from the Sacsayhuaman megaliths were assayed by the researchers, they confirmed that the rock was indeed limestone of high density. However, there were no obvious fossils and organic remains in it, but only clearly visible, fine-grained structure. Their conclusion was that the blocks had been subjected to intense heat between the time when they were quarried and the time when they were placed into the wall, and that this heat was sufficient to reduce the fossils to indeterminate, fine-grained structure. Of course, the Russian team said, we need more detailed researches and analysis in order to estimate the real reason for the thermal effects on the studied limestone. But the fact remains the fact. Recrystallization of biogenic siliceous limestone into microcrystalline siliceous limestone. The result of this process we can see in the material forming the wall polygonal blocks of Sacsayhuaman. In normal nature conditions, this process is absolutely impossible. Some magic presided over its construction. Jesus Gamara and I continue our exploration by climbing the stairways through the lines of the megalithic walls until we reach the slope above and can approach the dilapidated ruins littering the hilltop. These, says Gamara, indicating the ruins, are examples of what was done in the Ukunpacha period, the work of the Incas. Some of it, he makes clear, for example the structure of three concentric circles of walls, was very nicely done. The Incas called it Muyukmarca, he tells me. It was a tower that once rose to over 30 meters in height and was built as an imperial residence for the emperor, whose title was the Inca. Only later, and by extension, did the entire nation become the Incas. Gamara's argument is that in buildings like Muyukmarca, we are looking at the finest results the Incas were capable of. Yet these results are so patently inferior to the megaliths, and so different, that they must obviously be accepted as the work of another culture. Curiously, although such ideas are regarded as heresy by archaeologists today, this was not the case when the Andes first came under serious scientific scrutiny in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. For example, the great geographer Sir Clements Markham, who travelled extensively in Peru and wrote the classic study, The Incas of Peru, states that the Incas knew nothing of the origins of Sacsayhuaman. Garcilaso refers to towers, walls and gates built by the Incas, and even gives the names of the architects. But these were later defences, built within the great Cyclopean fortress. The outer lines must be attributed to the megalithic age. There is nothing of the kind which can be compared to them in any other part of the world. The Garcilaso mentioned by Markham is the chronicler Garcilaso Inca de la Vega, the son of a Spanish conquistador and an Inca princess, a heritage that gave him unique access to genuine Inca traditions, particularly since he was born and brought up in Cuzco and spoke Quechua, the language of the Incas, as his mother tongue. Had the megalithic elements of Sacsayhuaman been recent work, done in the century before Garcilaso's birth, there should have been fresh and clear memories, even eyewitness accounts, of so magnificent an achievement. But Garcilaso reports nothing of the sort, and instead can only offer magic as an explanation for what he describes as an even greater enigma than the seven wonders of the world. Here is what he wrote about Sacsayhuaman in his royal commentaries. Its proportions are inconceivable when one has not actually seen it. And when one has looked at it closely and examined it attentively, they appear to be so extraordinary that it seems as though some magic had presided over its construction, that it must be the work of demons instead of human beings. If we think, too, that this incredible work was accomplished without the help of a single machine, is it too much to say that it represents an even greater enigma than the seven wonders of the world? How can we explain the fact that these Peruvian Indians were able to split, carve, lift, carry, hoist, and lower such enormous blocks of stone, which are more like pieces of a mountain than building stones, and that they accomplished this, as I said before, without the help of a single machine or instrument? An enigma, such as this one, Garcilaso concluded, cannot be easily solved without the help of magic. Are we looking, yet again, at the handiwork of the magicians of the gods? Remembering that the great temple of Edfu in Upper Egypt was dedicated to the god Horus, who was sometimes depicted as a falcon and sometimes as a lion, it's intriguing to discover that the very name Sacsayhuaman means falcon, specifically satisfied falcon. Furthermore, it has long been recognized that Sacsayhuaman forms part of a large geoglyph, once visible from surrounding mountain peaks, in which it combines with the oldest quarters of Cuzco to form the shape of an immense feline, a puma, the closest creature in the Americas to an old world lion. The river Tulumayo, now diverted underground where it passes through the city, used to serve as the spine of this ancient lion. The torso was the spit of land between the Tulumayo to the east and the river Huatne, now also underground, to the west. Sacsayhuaman is still recognizable as the head of the lion. The zigzag walls that Jesus Gamarra attributes to the second Uranpacha episode of civilization in the Andes outline the upper side of its snout and muzzle, with the snout facing due west, the direction of the equinox sunset, just as the Great Sphinx of Giza faces due east, the direction of the equinox sunrise. There are traditions, supported by some modern excavations, of a network of tunnels under the Sphinx where mysterious treasures lie concealed. There are virtually identical traditions, again supported by recent excavations, of a labyrinth of enormously long tunnels under the head of the Sacsayhuaman lion, into which people descend to be lost forever or to emerge gibbering, mad, clutching items of treasure. Before we leave Sacsayhuaman, Jesus Gamarra takes me to a very strange place, a few hundred meters to the northeast of the megalithic walls, where a narrow stairway with a dozen steps appears to have been molded, not cut, into the midst of a massive boulder 20 feet high and as many wide. The stairway would only have been visible from above when it was made, but the boulder has been split into two parts by an earthquake, Gamarra thinks, with one side standing upright and the other leaning away from it at an angle of about 40 degrees, thus exposing the steps which we approach from ground level. At the point where the lowest of the steps would originally have touched the earth, Gamarra shows me the entrance to what looks like a deep, dark hole, now filled up with slabs of rock. It's a tunnel, he tells me. It goes under the ground all the way to Cuzco, but the government blocked the entrance to stop people exploring it. Civilizing Mission. Over the next few days, Jesus Gamarra shows me more of the evidence behind his theory. Indeed, now that I've understood his reasoning, I can see examples everywhere. In downtown Cuzco, the name of the city means the navel of the earth in the Quechua language of the Incas. He takes me to the ancient temple known as the Coricancha, which was converted into a cathedral after the Spanish conquest. The temple was used by the Incas. Indeed, it was central to their sacred life. But Gamarra does not believe that the Incas built it. In his view, though they undertook some repairs and added some minor constructions of their own, the bulk of the polished, precise, sharply angled grey granite stonework is from the Uranpacha, Second World period, and thus predates the Incas by thousands of years. He's reluctant to commit to a timescale, but suggests that the Coricancha was originally raised up more than 20,000 years ago in order to venerate an even earlier Hananpacha, First World, monolithic site, the original uncovered navel stone from which the city derives its name. The Incas preserved a tradition passed down to us by Garcilaso Inca de la Vega concerning the foundation of Cuzco. It seems that some sort of cataclysm had affected the world, some sort of disaster, and the inhabitants of the Andes had fallen into a very lowly state. Garcilaso was told by his own uncle, an Inca nobleman, that the people of that far-off time lived like wild beasts with neither order nor religion, neither villages nor houses, neither fields nor clothing. They lived in grottos and caves, and like wild game, fed upon grass and roots, wild fruits, and even human flesh. Seeing the condition they were in, our father the sun was ashamed for them. and he decided to send one of his sons and one of his daughters from heaven to earth to bring them the gifts of civilization and to teach them to obey his laws and precepts, to build houses and assemble together in villages. This royal couple, for like Isis and Osiris in Egypt, they were brother and sister as well as husband and wife, traveled the land carrying a golden rod given to them by the sun god, who instructed them to plunge it into the earth at various points until they found a place where it would disappear at one thrust, and there they were to establish their court. Finally, the Inca and his bride entered into Cuzco Valley. There, at a spot called Cuzco Kara Urumi, the uncovered navel stone, they tried their rod, and not only did it sink into the earth, but it disappeared entirely. Thus our imperial city came into existence. There is an exact parallel here to the story of the Zoroastrian patriarch Yima, recounted in chapter 7, who was given a golden poniard by a god and who likewise plunged it into the earth as the founding act of a civilization. And what a civilization it was that flowered in the Andes. Certainly, the extraordinary accomplishment of the giant edifices of the Coricancha seems to suggest the application of more than ordinary skills and abilities. The huge granite blocks are so finely cut, Gamara insists they were molded into shape, that the towering inner chambers look more like the parts of some gigantic, sophisticated machine than of a temple. Adding to this impression are the complicated series of grooves, channels, holes, and niches indented into several of the blocks, giving them the appearance of printed circuit boards from which the circuitry has been removed, leaving only empty tracks. After spending some hours inside the Coricancha, Gamara takes me outside into the neighboring Loreto Street, which he promises will provide a particularly graphic demonstration of his arguments. It's a narrow alley, bounded by high walls, and in these walls, surmounted by sections of modern plasterwork, four distinctly different styles of stone masonry are visible. Of these, Gamara says two are Inca, Ucunpacha, one is from the colonial period around the 17th or 18th century, and one dates back to the Uranpacha period. Along a large part of one side of the street, there are granite blocks that are every bit as fine and beautifully fitted as those inside the Coricancha. Indeed, this section of the wall is the exterior elevation of one of the Coricancha's large chambers, and therefore, according to Gamara, is from the Uranpacha period. The joints between the blocks are so thin, and yet so complex with interlocking elements, that they do indeed seem molded together. In addition, and he has previously shown me examples of this at Sacsayhuaman as well, there is a curious glassy sheen around the joints, which he believes is evidence of vitrification caused by exposure to intense heat. He makes a convincing case that what we're looking at is different from the normal shine that passers-by might impart to the stone by rubbing and touching it over the centuries. Indeed, the vitrified elements, and I make no claim that this is what they are, form a clear skin over the underlying blocks that is particularly evident where areas have been damaged or broken. Beside the courses of Uranpacha blocks, though not rising to the same height, are others that look superficially similar, but that on closer examination prove to be much more crudely made, with obvious tool marks, no glassy sheen, and yawning gaps between some of the joints. Good Ucunpacha work, comments Gamara, made by the Incas. They were doing their best to imitate the Uranpacha style, but they couldn't quite succeed, and their efforts got poorer and poorer. He indicates four courses of irregular cobbles, higher up, with wide spaces between the joints filled by adobe. Colonial period, he says. Finally, he takes me to the other side of the street to show me a long section of dry stone wall. The cobbles have been subjected to a certain amount of shaping, but are clumsily and unevenly fitted together. There's no adobe in the gaping joints, made by the Incas, says Gamara. And what's the opinion of the archaeologists, I ask? A grin. They recognize the colonial work, but they've fooled themselves into believing that everything else was done by the Incas. They are so convinced there was no earlier, more advanced civilization here that they're blind to the huge differences between the Uranpacha blocks and the Inca workmanship. I suppose the fact that the Incas themselves sometimes attempted to imitate the Uranpacha style, at least in that section over there, makes things more complicated, I suggest. More complicated, yes, but still they should be able to see such profound changes in the quality of workmanship, especially when examples like this are found all over the region, should give the hint that different cultures were involved. Sacred Valley. If the focus around the Coricancha is the fine megalithic work that Gamara associates with the Uranpacha period, there are many other structures in the area that he sees as pure Hananpacha, the oldest phase of Andean civilization, where the work in stone is entirely monolithic. Several great outcrops of bedrock have been completely refashioned into bizarre complexes of steps, terraces, and alcoves. At Kenco, one such outcrop a little way beyond Sacsayhuaman, there are multiple snake-like grooves and channels winding their way down the sides of a mystic dome filled with caves, ledges, passageways, and hidden niches. On the very top, again carved or molded from the raw stone, is an oval protrusion surmounted by a stubby double prong. There are also the outlines of various animals, a puma, a condor, a llama, and yet more terraces and steps leading nowhere. We go on to another sculpted outcrop 100 meters tall, known locally as the Temple of the Moon. At the base of the mound, there's a dark, mysterious, folded slit that leads within, along the edge of which, at about shoulder height, emerges the sinuous, sculpted form of a serpent with a strange, bulbous head. To the right of the entrance, the rock takes distinctive shape as the head of an elephant, complete with trunk, eyes, and ears. About the serpent, there's no doubt. But is the elephant an example of what psychologists call pareidolia, the human tendency to see meaningful shapes and patterns that don't really exist? Or did some cunning artist in ancient times deliberately set out to sculpt the appearance of an elephant emerging from the rock? If the latter, then we have a problem with history, since the last species related to elephants that could be portrayed here, Cuvieronius, became extinct in South America at least 6,000 years ago, while the Incas who are supposed to have made the Temple of the Moon date back less than 1,000 years. I'll have more to say about the serpent and the elephant later. Meanwhile, as I stoop down through the slit in the rock to enter the temple, I notice another carved stone animal. A puma this time, and somewhat damaged, at my feet. Now I'm inside what feels like the womb of the mountain, and a soft, velvety gloom envelops me. The cave is 5 meters wide, with an organic, meandering feel to it, but to my left, a couple of deep alcoves have been cut into the wall, while 20 meters ahead, a shaft of brilliant golden light finds its way through some aperture in the rocky mound above and illuminates a stone plinth about 1.5 meters high with 2 large steps. I climb up onto the plinth and sit there, my back resting against the living rock, deep in thought. Gamara says this place is from the most ancient Hananpacha epoch, that it has nothing to do with the Incas, and that it long predates the Uranpacha period that was responsible for the megaliths of Sacsayhuaman and the stunning, high-precision architecture of the Coricancha. Looking around, taking in the atmosphere, I'm more and more inclined to agree with him. The people who made this cave temple were not the same as those who made the Coricancha. It's not just different building styles that are involved in each of the different periods. It's a different ethic and a different spiritual heartbeat. From the Temple of the Moon, we go straight on to Pisac, a drive of 18 kilometers along the edge of the sacred valley of the Vilcanota River. Its waters sparkle far below us, while all around the spectacular mountain country glows emerald, thanks to countless fertile terraces that the Incas undoubtedly did create and that provided their empire with vast agricultural wealth. The sheer magnitude of the task of organizing and building the thousands upon thousands of neat, dry stone walls that hem in these terraces, which are found in every viable spot throughout the length and breadth of the Andes, almost beggars belief. It's a comparable achievement to the architectural wonders, and so too are many other aspects of Inca civilization, which I do not mean to diminish in any way with the suggestion that there might have been earlier cultures. Quite the contrary. I suspect part of the reason the Incas were so remarkable is that they were the inheritors of an incredible legacy of wisdom and knowledge from the past. So it's in a setting of great natural beauty overlooking the sacred valley that we explore Pisac, a site less famous, but in many ways more spectacular than Machu Picchu, which lies another 70 kilometers to the northwest. As at Machu Picchu, the centerpiece at Pisac, around which everything else seems focused, is an Intihuatana. The word means hitching post of the sun. A massive outcrop of rock, shaped by human hands in what Gemara calls the Hanan Pacha style, with a gnomon sticking up from its summit. Surrounding it, and in some cases molded to its surface, are walls of beautifully shaped polygonal blocks in the later Uran Pacha style, which seem to have been designed to cradle and protect the Intihuatana. And around them are Ukun Pacha, Inca structures, of simpler, cruder stonework. Each of these cultures, Gemara explains, venerated and respected the culture that went before. They expressed their feelings of respect by building over and around the work of their predecessors and by attempting to copy what they did. As I showed you in Loreto Street, the Incas sought to emulate the Uran Pacha style, but they didn't have the knowledge or the right conditions to do such a good job. By the right conditions, Gemara means the lowered gravity and greater malleability of stone that he hypothesizes in past epochs. But I don't need to embrace that to accept that his observations about the different building styles and their likely origination by different cultures make complete sense of what we're looking at. I see many more examples of these three distinctive styles, sometimes with Gemara to guide me, sometimes not. Machu Picchu itself, which I've written about at length in previous books, is of course the archetypal Hanan Pacha site, adopted and overbuilt by later cultures. Then there's a mysterious little cave, overlooking a remote valley through the floor of which passes the rail track connecting Cuzco to Machu Picchu. It's quite a clamber 300 meters up the almost sheer valley side and along a narrow track, but the end result is worth the effort. At the front of the cave, a black andesite boulder has been sculpted, or molded, into a curious-looking shrine with a step pyramid motif engraved upon it. Treasure hunters have been here and dynamited the shrine, but enough of it survived the explosion to get a sense of how beautiful it must have been before it was attacked. In the same Hanan Pacha style, one wall of the cave appears to have been planed smooth, and an alcove with absolutely precise straight edges, as though milled by a machine tool, has been cut into it. But on the other side, on my right as I look out of the cave, an Inca wall of rough stone, mortared together with adobe, has been built, and into this wall, crudely done, six alcoves have been fashioned in an obvious attempt to mimic the high-precision, rock-cut alcove on the left. The qualities and styles of workmanship are so completely different that it makes no sense, as is presently the case, to insist that both the rock-cut work and the crude wall were produced by the same culture. Gemara's theory that a much older monument has been honored and mimicked by the Incas better fits the evidence before my eyes. Déjà vu. Heading out of Peru on our way to Bolivia, we stop in the town of Puno on the shores of Lake Titicaca, 3,812 meters, 12,507 feet above sea level. And from there, the next day, we drive 22 kilometers south to a dramatic mesa at an altitude of 4,023 meters, 13,198 feet, on top of which is perched the archaeological site of Cutimbo. The main features of the site, several tall towers, some circular, some square, and known collectively as chulapas, are visible from the road. They are thought to have been built as tombs for the nobility of a local Indian culture, the Lupacas, who were made vassals of the Incas in the period between AD 1470 and AD 1532. Undoubtedly, there were burials within the Chulapas in that period, but the possibility must be considered that these were intrusive, and that the towers, made from fine polygonal blocks that have all the hallmarks of Jesus Gamarra's Urrenpacha style, are much older than their latest use. I'm getting accustomed to the thin air of the Andes by now, but it's a long hike through yellow pampas grass, up the sides of the mesa, under a burning morning sun. Once we get to the top, however, my fatigue vanishes when I start finding, and Santha starts photographing, really interesting imagery carved in high relief on the sides of a number of the towers, and on scattered blocks lying at random here and there, the result of more demonstrations.